Okay, thank you. Yes, I'll be talking today about a project in which I got involved. It was actually conducted as part of Nitro Europe at one of their so-called super sites, in which they're attempting to establish nitrogen balances, nitrogen gains and losses from different ecosystems around Europe. The site in which I got involved is actually in Unzingen near Zurich in Switzerland. It's an intensively managed pasture, and I should just note that the main author of this paper, Simon Le Huger, was a postdoc employed by the Agroscope Reckenholz in Zurich to do the modeling work. The other guys on this project, Pierluigi Albrecht and the others, were all the measurement people involved in getting the very detailed measurements from this site. And then, of course, that's me at the end. I just helped Simon with the modeling. The model that we used in this project is EcoSys, a model that I've developed over the last 20 years or so. And again, as I said, was run by Simon. Simon provided me with all the graphics, so that's why I come in last on the presentation list. So I'm really indebted to my colleagues for all this work. Okay, there's probably no need to go over some of these slides. It's just that nitrous oxide emissions are a key part of the emissions attributed to agriculture in all the IPCC assessments. And of these emissions, those of nitrous oxide from arable soils are really a large part. And how are these nitrous oxide emissions currently assessed? There's a lot of field measurements using both micrometeorological and chamber techniques. Those are good for site-specific applications, but they're very difficult to conduct on a large-scale systematic basis. As a result of this difficulty, we have a lot of emission factors that are being used now, briefly summarized in this equation here. Generally speaking, then, production of nitrogen is multiplied by an emission factor. However, the emission factors, although they currently stand at 1%, they're highly variable, and an earlier presentation demonstrated, they can easily vary, in fact, by an order of magnitude. Therefore, there's been a move over the years through a Tier 2, which is kind of a more of a site-specific application of Tier 1 with some limited modeling, toward possibly at some point a Tier 3, which will involve more agroecosystem modeling to account for local, pedo, and climatic conditions. And there are some of the models on the right that are engaged in some of this activity. And again, there's probably not much need to go through this in too much detail. The two key processes from which nitrous oxide emissions are generated are those of nitrification, in which N2O is an intermediate byproduct of the nitrification process conducted generally under aerobic conditions by certain bacteria. Nitrite product is oxidized to nitrate, and this becomes a substrate in a denitrification sequence from which N2O is generated. The fertilizer application is primarily thought to drive the nitrification sequence, although by raising levels of nitrate in soil, it also drives denitrification. But this is very site and condition specific, depending on levels of anaerobicity in the soil. Okay, how can we model this? I've chosen to take a very basic approach in which we try to take basic microbial kinetics, the kinetics of the microbial population by which these transfers are driven, and we try to model them directly using energetics. So as a template for all microbial transformations in EcoSys, we calculate, for example, in this case for denitrification, that in during oxidation of soil organic carbon, in the presence of oxygen, heterotrophs derives energy from the reduction of oxygen to water. So there is a redox reaction in the course of which 4 electrons are transferred per mole of carbon oxidized, and this provides a certain amount of energy which drives microbial growth, and the microbial biomass which results from that growth in turn then drives the subsequent oxidation of, in this case, this is dissolved organic carbon in the soil. So the energetics of this are fairly well known and can be parameterized directly from microbiological studies. The key question with regard to nitrous oxide generation then is, if oxygen is insufficient, facultative anaerobes can derive additional energy from the transfer of electrons through a cascade from nitrate through nitrite to N2O into N2, And in this way, they can gain additional energy for growth. But note that that energy yield per mole of carbon oxidized is much lower. Therefore, these transformations tend to occur less rapidly than would be the case in an oxygenated soil. So this, again, can be parameterized from basic microbiological studies and does not require any model-specific parameterization. Similarly, during nitrification, in the presence of oxygen, ammonium is oxidized to nitrite, in the course of which 6 electrons are transferred from oxygen to water. And this allows the oxidation of, it allows the fixation of a certain amount of carbon, the subsequent oxidation of which drives microbial growth. These terms here, again, are derived from basic microbiological studies, which indicate a net carbon uptake per gram of carbon oxidized. So, again, this can be parameterized from basic studies. However, if oxygen is insufficient, there appears to be an additional electron transfer which can occur from nitrite to N2O, allowing further oxidation of ammonium, and this allows further fixation of CO2 and subsequent oxidation to drive microbial biomass, although the energy yield of this, as far as I've been able to derive, is much lower. However, it does drive some microbial growth, which again drives the subsequent oxidation of ammonium. All right. How does the microbial biomass drive the reduction of these different substrates, oxygen, nitrate, nitrite, etc.? We drive this through the kinetics of the redox reactions. These are primarily monotype kinetics. We have specific oxidation rates. Here we have, this is driven by the microbial biomass, as indicated in the previous slides, and also by the concentration of dissolved organic carbon that's present in the soil. When under aerobic conditions, this potential rate of C oxidation is constrained by the actual concentration and consequent uptake of CO2, uptake of oxygen in the soil, and this is defined again by the concentration of oxygen at microbial microsites. The shortfall, the difference between the potential and the actual rate enabled by oxygen drives a cascading transfer of electrons from nitrate to nitrite to N2O, and again the kinetics driven by the concentrations of nitrate, nitrite, and N2O with respect to Michaelis-Menten constants. Again, these have all been derived in the literature. The problem in parameterization really comes from choosing which of these values from different studies you want to select, and you have to be a little bit careful to get a value that comes from a really good experimental protocol. But again, all this can be parameterized without any model-derived values having to be used. The question then becomes, how does the gas move through the soil and what controls the oxygen concentration that you use in these equations? We have here, in the model, we represent both the water and the air as they change dynamically in the soil, as well as the soil surfaces. We represent explicit convection dispersion, volatilization, dissolution. We have transfers both in the aqueous and the gaseous phases, and then, of course, the exchange between the two, and then radial uptake to microbial surfaces, all of which determines the O2 at the microbial microsite and, therefore, the uptake by the microbial surfaces. The main point I want to make from this kind of detailed scheme is that there's a nonlinear relationship between gaseous diffusion and air-filled porosity, and this high degree of nonlinearity causes sharp transitions between aerobic and anaerobic states at certain levels of air-filled porosity that can occur in the soil. This transition really is strongly affected by temperature, by soil warming, because it increases O2 demand and lowers oxygen solubility. So these transfer dynamics are both porosity or water-filled porosity or air-filled porosity, as well as highly temperature-sensitive. Again, all of these transfers can be parameterized from basic physical processes and do not require any model-specific values. all right, where do we test this stuff? I was fortunate to be able to work with these guys at the Unzingen site. It's an intensively managed clover grass pasture, pretty heavy nitrogen applications, 4 to 5 cuts per year, so it's pretty productive, pretty intensively managed. These guys are out there with all kinds of equipment. I want to point out specifically today, though, their use of automatic static chambers to measure nitrous oxide emissions. They had 2 to 4 chambers running continuously throughout the experiment on a 15-minute timing measurement cycle. To measure N2O was associated with an FTIR device, pretty high-tech stuff. I went out and visited their site, and I'm always amazed at all the cables and wires running around, how guys figure out how to do this stuff. But they're very clever with instruments, and they're able to record all these data, some of which I'll be presenting today. I can't really go through everything that we did. Now, the modeling protocol, this is quite important in order to reproduce site conditions before you start doing your comparison. You've got to have a spin-up period. Simon, for some reason, went with 280 years. I thought that was a bit long, but it's not a problem. We had 7 years of weather data, and this equilibrates the model under site conditions. So the spin-up protocol is important. The model run results from which we'll be looking at today actually continued from January through December. Using management practice, I won't go through the details, but all the cutting dates, fertilization dates, there was both cattle slurry as well as mineral fertilizer applied on specified dates at the field site. There's a bunch of site characters that we needed to have, soil attributes, bulk density, fuel capacity, wilting point, etc. All these soil sampling measurements are extremely important in getting the right inputs into the model. There was also an issue around macroporosity, a point to which I'll return later, that really affects water flow through soils and needs to be represented in models. We do have a complete transfer of or a complete treatment of macropores in the model using Poiseuille-Hagen dynamics, as well as micropore transfer using Richards function. There was an input for macroporosity, but I will come back to this point later. And again, the plant types, a clover and grass mixture, these are generic model values that inputs that we use to generate these plants in the model. So these plants grew competitively. There were no calibration of internal model parameters. They were all derived from the studies to which I referred in those earlier slides. Okay, just very quickly, just to capture the carbon dynamics. I won't be able to go into this today. The top slide here shows the model clover leaf area. The bottom slide, the grass leaf. The next slide, the grass leaf area. The sum of the two leaf areas is shown as the red line here, and compared against values measured using an optical device continuously through the growing season. There's a bit of a difference in measurement here. The model values are a physical leaf area. The measured values are an optical leaf area. The two are not always the same. But we did want to ensure that we had approximately the growth dynamics, both in terms of LII and biomass, because, of course, the carbon moving through the system is what really drives these transformations, as indicated again in those earlier slides. We also have to check that we've got a good idea about how the soil water, down here in the soil temperature, whether they were adequately modeled. For the most part, they were okay. Now, there's freezing events in the soil, which apparently weren't picked up by the TDR probes. These are the symbols here, the TDR probes. There are some freezing events which result in transient reductions in water contents, and then subsequent thawing, the water content comes back up. I'd just like to point out 2005 was a little bit dry. 2006, there was a drying period. 2007 was pretty wet all the way through. And then here we have the soil nitrogen contents, ammonium and nitrate. That wet year resulted in sustained high ammonium concentrations due presumably to slower nitrification. This is what was modeled in any case. All right, here are the N2O fluxes. I really want to focus on this for the talk today. Up here we have a whole bunch of applications here, both organic and inorganic. We have the modeled and the measured N2O fluxes down here. Now, these are daily aggregates from 2005 through 2007. We just aggregated both the modeled and the measured results for a quick overview. And as you can see, sometimes the peaks are captured by the model. Sometimes you get model peaks with no measured peaks, and sometimes you get measured peaks with or very small model peaks. So it's really a challenge getting the amplitude as well as the timing of these fluxes. There are a couple of things I want to compare, because at some time we got very substantial emissions in response to, for example, a slurry application. However, at other times, in response to a very similar application at a similar time of year under similar environmental conditions, we got hardly any emissions at all. So I'd just like to zoom in, for example, on some of these contrasts to get an idea of where the emissions are coming from, or alternatively not coming from, in response to comparable applications of, in this case, slurry. Here's the 2005 application. Now, here's where these automated chamber measurements come in really handy. We have here the hourly measurements here from the 2 to 4 chambers that were operating at the time. The coefficient of variation for these chambers is pretty high. It was about, on a daily basis, it was about 115%. This, unfortunately, is typical of N2O readings, but they were sort of summarized here in the vertical blue lines. You can see, and there's a tremendous temporal variability in these measurements, which means that, and a lot of these emissions, of course, are occurring at night, so that it's very difficult to really capture these emissions using manual chambers, which are typically operated during the day. It's far too much of a hit-and-miss operation, I think, and that's why these automated chambers, which really attracted me to this project, I think are an extremely valuable resource for assessing N2O emissions. We have here the time of the application was here. There was about a 9-day period with very low emissions, then a rainfall which raised the soil water contents. Note that the water-filled porosity is quite high here, 0.8 to 0.9, dipping down, then coming back up. But it seemed to be... although similar environmental conditions existed for both 05 and 07, almost no emissions in 07 in spite of high water contents, and this appeared to be attributed to a rainfall 9 days after application in 05 that seems to have stimulated this emission that we see up here. So these rainfall-driven events appear to be quite important in N2O emission, because they do at least temporarily block off the top part of the soil and impede oxygen flow into the soil, at least temporarily. We also had summer applications of slurry. Here's one in July with very small fluxes, even smaller in the model. Here's another emission in which the model fluxes are too large. There was hardly any emission at all. And then there's one in 07. Again, these are all very similar slurry applications at similar times of year, but giving very different N2O emissions as a consequence. So I want to zoom in now on these three applications and see what really caused the differences there. The first one here we see in 05. The timing appears to be pretty good. However, note, as I said earlier, 05 and 06 had dry periods, and what appears to have happened in the soil, according to the field observers, was that there were very substantial macropores, cracks actually, soil cracks that opened up that apparently affected the hydrology of the site. So you see here that the modeled water-filled porosity in this second graph here is substantially higher here than is the measured water-filled porosity. And this is attributed to a lot of water running down these big cracks that appeared in this high clay soil. The modeled results, nonetheless, are a little bit lower than the measured results. There was an emission period that it did occur here, but the timing worked out fairly well. In 06, the model appears to have been tricked into indicating a fairly substantial emission, whereas in fact there was almost no emission measured after this 06. Now 06, again, this was during a drying period. There was fairly substantial cracking occurring in the soil, which resulted in a very large macroporosity, so that, water-filled pore space in the model was considerably higher than the measured results. And although there was a fairly substantial rainfall, about 50 millimeters, this does not seem to have registered in the TDR probes, again due to the cracks. So the model simulated a fairly substantial emission, although because the soil water content in the field remained low, those emissions do not appear to have been recorded. In 07, now as I said before, that was a wetter year. The soil remained wet. The cracks were closed up. And the water-filled pore space appears to have been fairly closely tracked. The lines here, again, are the model results. The blue symbols here all jammed together are the TDR probe results. And the emission event was reasonably well captured, although you can see the very high temporal variability in the automated chamber measurements. Another point that Simon really went on about quite a bit in his work here is this modeled rate of root water uptake and of root nitrogen uptake and the extent to which this suppressed emissions. He seemed to feel that the rapid uptake by removing substrate for N2O generation, both through nitrification and denitrification, may have resulted in some of the reduced model output. So a root N uptake is an issue. So, with regard to the summer slurry applications, 2005, good timing, but emissions were underestimated. 2006, rapid drainage through large cracks in soil may have caused the soils to be drier than the rainfall would have indicated. Consequently, the model tended to overestimate emissions. And here, wetter year, better water-filled pore space and better emissions. Finally, I'd like to look at the effects of some mineral fertilizer applications on subsequent N2O emissions. Here in May, there was a 30 kilogram per hectare fertilizer application, which resulted in fairly large fluxes. 30th September that same year, the same application, but much smaller fluxes. The first application here, in May, there was fairly high water-filled pore space, as indicated in the diagram in the middle of the page. The simulation, the modeled flux here came out about 4 days earlier than the measured flux, and it was thought this might have something to do with the rate at which the ammonium nitrate pellets, in which form the fertilizer was applied, may have dissolved in the soil. This rate of fertilizer dissolution then becomes an issue. The pellets did apparently dissolve somewhat slowly, and this may have led to a delayed emission from those in the model in which, because ammonium nitrate is fairly soluble, the fertilizer may have been thought to be, would have dissolved immediately in the model. The same application in 06 occurred under drier soil conditions, and therefore emissions were much smaller. So clearly the drier soil, as well as the sudden cooling of the soil following a rainfall in this date, apparently suppressed emissions both in the field and in the model. We can try to get a summary representation of these fluxes by looking at the probability density function for the 3 years, 2005, 2006, and 2007. And as is very typical for N2O emissions, these are just emissions that exceeded a certain base threshold. You get a lot of emissions that are very small, and you get a few emissions that are very large. And this is really the challenge to quantifying and aggregating N2O emissions. The probability density function from the automated chambers and from the model in 05 were fairly similar. In 07, they were fairly similar. In 06, although the model did simulate higher N2O emissions during peak events, those weren't really picked up in the chambers for that year. And again, that may be due to the altered hydrology from the soil cracking. To summarize the ecological drivers, what Simon did here was he binned all the simulated emissions into different classes and attempt to relate them to existing ammonium and nitrate concentrations in soil, existing water-filled porosity and temperature, and ammonium and nitrate uptake to see if there were some general conclusions which could be made regarding ecological drivers. There appeared to be some increase in emissions at the higher end of the nitrate concentrations in the soil. So again, binning nitrate concentrations, the higher concentrations appear to be associated with higher emissions. But again, there's a lot of scatter that doesn't really suggest that there's a direct relationship between the two variables. Water-filled porosity, most emissions tend to occur between 0.6 and 0.9. Most of the model emissions occurred sort of in the, say, 15 to 20 temperature degree range. The one consistent relationship was that with higher rates of root nitrogen uptake, emissions appeared to be suppressed, which I guess flows from the fact that rapid nitrogen removal is an effective way of reducing N2O emissions. So, in conclusion, the main objective of this effort was to model N2O flux dynamics and test them against chamber measurements. In terms of the model evaluation, it's really been the first opportunity to test against automated chamber measurements from a temperate, intensively managed pasture, so it is a real opportunity for me to get involved in this project. Plant growth and soil drivers appear to work out fairly good. They're actually comparatively easy to model, certainly in comparison to N2O, which is, I think for modelers, a continuous source of humiliation. But the drivers are fairly straightforward. We've been doing that for a long time already. At an annual time scale, and these are Simon's conclusions, the temporal trend of N2O emissions peaks was mostly well predicted. The intensity of emission peaks were usually within the range of measurement uncertainty, although there were times clearly when they weren't. From the case studies, for the examinations in more detail that we did, N2O emissions are affected by very small changes in soil porosity with wetting and drying, so it is very much of a threshold response. As you move up and down through that 0.7 water-filled porosity threshold, there appear to be strong changes in N2O emissions, which in the model are driven by these changes in aerobicity, which occur when air-filled porosity declines below a certain threshold and starts to alter the rate of oxygen diffusion into the soil. However, this issue around macroporosity and changing macroporosity with soil drying, that's something that I think is going to have to come into the modeling, certainly when you've got these high clay soils. N2 emissions are reduced at very high water contents, both through inhibited nitrification and through the reduction of N2O to N2. That occurred in the model, and that's why very few emissions were actually recorded or measured at these very high water-filled pore spaces. And again, the issue around competition for mineral and between roots and microorganisms that does suggest that the application of slurry or a fertilizer during periods of rapid growth may be the key way in which to reduce emissions from these pastures. Okay, thanks. Yes.
But just to point out the mechanistic process-based model, I mean, compared to the alternative, compared to the IPCC default emission factor, the process-based models do better most of the time.
Yeah.
I would point out. So even though it's difficult, still compared to the alternative that's being used, there's some
Yeah. I think we are making progress. I think the real key thing, though, if models are to improve, measurements have to improve. The level of testing of modeling of model N2O emissions needs to be tightened up way further from where it is now. And I think micrometeorological measurements, there's a bit of a spatial variability issue because of the size of the fetch that you need for N2O, but then these automated chambers allowing more detailed and tighter comparisons, progress in this front is absolutely vital if models are to move, if this type of modeling is to move forward. So it is difficult. I think it's a challenge we are gradually resolving. I think there are gradual improvements, but those improvements will not be possible without sustained improvements in measurement methodology of the type that we see here. So that's why I want to try to keep on with these people for a while. I think these automated chamber measurements are going to be vital to improving model performance. Oh, sure, yeah.
I know the automated chambers, were somebody else running them.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Thank God.
Would they analyze N2O on site, or would they collect gas samples automatically and then take them back to the lab?
Yeah, the way these things work, they're quite ingenious. It's actually a closed-loop system. So when the chamber comes down, their chambers were closed for 15 minutes, during which air is continuously circulated through the chamber and measured in real time using an FTIR device. So I went into their trailer, and you can actually see the N2O concentrations rising in the chamber, and then the chamber would open, they'd drop off, then they'd switch to the next chamber. The CO2 concentrations would gradually rise. So it's just like measuring CO2. You measure the slope and count.